And you may be right if you are listening to The Morning Edge this rainy morning here in Florida. And here is your host, Augie Schmidt.
Oh. Well, anyway, Augie's enough for you. I'm a four-letter word, and there's certain people who I'm sure use that four-letter word in different ways. But good morning, Floyd, and it is rainy out there. And by golly, at some point in time, we're going to have a contact with Mitch Perry from WMNF to talk about the elections and the burn and how Bernie is he. Paul Krugman seems to think that Bernie is a little on the dreamer side. The enemy is good. Enemy of the good is the perfect, inferring that we maybe need somebody who is a little more pragmatic and less idealistic. He's on the one hand, he's favoring Bernie, and that people need to follow their ideals and their heart. And Welcome to America, I think. What is the name of that song that Bernie's got going? His theme song, his new... It's Come Back to America, right? Finding America, I think. Isn't that what it is?
I haven't heard it.
Oh,
but
it's really terrific.
Bernie and Donald, if they get elected, if they run against each other, get elected, they still have to cope with Congress and the Supreme Court. So they're not going to just take away their wild agendas of building a mile-high wall in Canada and throwing all the immigrants out. They still have to deal with reality. I think people like the fact that they're independent, mm-hmm. that they're not beholden to special interests. Donald, because he has so much money, and Bernie, because he doesn't seem to be motivated by money.
Well, you know, they've asked how he's going to finance all this, and of course he has said he's going to put a tax on trade transactions on the internet and everywhere else that you can. And Europe is already doing that, by the way, folks. But the other thing that they tax is what is called a use tax. Aside from a VAT tax, the Europeans tax your use of energy, gasoline in particular. But with gasoline prices falling, and I said on this show probably 2-3 months ago, you can see buck and a half gasoline per gallon, you're going to see it lower than that. I think you could see something approaching a buck a gallon. Is that going to mean an onslaught of SUVs and trucks? It's already happening. The trucks are being made lighter. Aluminum and other things are being used to make I think Ford has got an all aluminum or General Motors, one of the two, truck to make them light so they're more fuel efficient. But the different efficiencies in the use of gasoline and the use of things like that is going to increase the drive down of the price of oil. And of course now with Iran coming on board and Bernie saying we need to make a normal business relationship with Iran, we need to find them a business comrade, if you will, is stirred the dust in the Clinton campaign. Oh no, we can't do that. You have no idea what those people. They are sending people into Syria now. Yeah, they are. And what are they doing? They're shutting down ISIS, is what the Shia of Iran are doing, and they've been doing that all along. And of course, when we were there, they were fighting us to drive us out because they were siding with the Shia of southern Iraq. But the big deal is here, you've got Bernie saying we're going to go back to pre-1953 with Iran. He didn't say it that way. Well, what was pre-1953, Floyd? You know what it was prior to 1953? Were you around at that time?
Yeah, I was around. Sure, absolutely. Yeah, we had the Eisenhower administration. We just ended the Korean War. And we had overthrown the Shah of Iran because of the fact...
No.
Well, we were getting ready to overthrow the Shah of Iran overthrow and put into power the Shah of Iran because...
The Prime Minister of Iran...
Mossadegh,
that's right. You got it.
Yes.
And a lot of people don't understand what that means, but they had a regular elected government at that time. No Ayatollahs, none of the nonsense. And we've got the situation of... our government going in and imposing a government upon them. That's why they loved us so much, and that's why the 79 election and their only hope to throw us out and to throw the Shah out was just to bring in the Ayatollah, who was hiding in Paris for years and years and years, not approved of by the general populace, but as a way to get rid of the power of the U.S. and the Shah and the holding of their oil hostage along with everything else. They threw out the Shah and brought in the Ayatollah in 1979. Do we have a guest? guest on the show.
We have
here.
A guest called Mitch Perry. Mitch Perry, welcome to the Morning Edge.
Morning, Mitch.
Good morning.
I was just talking about what Bernie has said about making a rapprochement in terms of business with Iran, not just in a nuclear deal, but going a lot further. And I happen to agree with him. I said when the CIA wrote a letter apologizing to Iran for what we did in 1953 and why they reacted in 1979 the way they did, and now they're coming full circle back to the United States in lots of ways, in Western Europe in particular, being the largest natural gas depository in all of Asia, in the Middle East. Maybe Bernie's got a point, but you're going to be going to New Hampshire and observing all of the good goings on between the two parties and within the parties. But yesterday, you conducted a really interesting interview with Tim. What was the spelling of his last name?
Canova.
Canova, like Judy Canova from the old days of Groucho Marx.
No, I don't remember her.
But your interview brought out the battle that's coming in the much-needed battle that's coming within the leadership of the DNC with Debbie Wasserman Schultz blocking the debates, and now they're going to have a forum on CNN on Sunday night at 9 o'clock with the football underneath it all. What was the nature of your conversation with Tim Canova?
Well, Tim Canova is going to be running against, he's a Democrat. He'll be running in the primary against Debbie Wasserman Schultz, which, of course, is going to be this August here in Florida in the 23rd Congressional District, which is Broward and parts of Palm Beach County. And what's interesting, Augie, is that, you know, basically, and this goes for Republicans, it goes for Democrats, it's so rare for an incumbent to get challenged by their own member of their own party, right? I mean, and if that happened, I mean, I remember Cindy Sheehan ran against Nancy Pelosi a decade or so ago, but it was very symbolic. I mean, there was never any chance. I'm not sure what the chance is for Canova. We know that nationally, there's a lot of Democrats who have it in for Debbie Wasserman Schultz because of, as you mentioned, the lack of debate, the seemingly, you know, controlling Hillary Clinton strategy here, and a host of other issues that have really alienated a lot of Democrats from Wasserman Schultz for her kind of conservative stances on some issues. But I'm not sure, I don't know, I haven't seen any polling yet, what's the feeling in District 23, because that's what it's all going to matter. But nevertheless, at least he's taking her on, and he seems to be a credible guy at first look, you know. I mean, yeah, as you heard, we interviewed him yesterday for roughly half an hour. He's a professor of law, he's very immersed in economic theory, and he's been doing this, you know, teaching basically, he's been an academic most of his career. And he knows a lot about economics. He's very much in the Bernie Sanders mode in terms of how he feels about Wall Street and, you know, how we haven't, this country hasn't gone far enough in protecting ourselves against the banks. And he apparently helped out in crafting, was on a committee to help craft the Dodd-Frank bill that came out a few years ago. And he has interesting things to say about that. He actually agrees with some of the conservative critics about it, but also with some of the liberals who think it hasn't gone far enough in some ways. So he's a very interesting guy, and what it's going to do, though, is he will get a lot of, you know, be funded very well, right? Because there are so many Democrats who would love to see Wasserman Schultz ousted as the DNC chair. Apparently, that's not going to happen, even though there's been these different liberal groups have been collecting signatures calling the DNC to oust her.
Yeah,
but nevertheless, you know, he's a symbol. Everybody can put all their wrath of Wasserman Schultz into him, you know, give him money. And maybe he'll make it a competitive race come this August.
Yeah, well, you got Alan Grayson out there also being a curmudgeon in the whole situation. These two guys could really form the beginnings of something of a revolution within the Democratic Party in the state and nationally as well.
Let me just pick up on that, because, by the way, you know, Alan Grayson, as we know, is running for U.S. Senate in the Democratic primary, and he's running against primarily several candidates, but the biggest one, of course, is South Florida Congressman Patrick Murphy. And a poll came out this week. There hasn't been much polling on the Senate race so far. Poll came out earlier this week, Florida Atlantic University, and it has Grayson up 7 points over Murphy, 27-20. You know, not you know, huge lead, but an interesting lead, because basically, the Democratic establishment, not only just in Florida, but nationally, is all embracing Patrick Murphy. I guess the reasoning they are doing that is they feel that Murphy's more centrist, right? You could argue he's conservative even. He used to be a Republican. Is that people feel he can win against him over the Republicans nominee, whereas they're a little more concerned about Grayson. But maybe that's an outdated theory. I mean, I'm not sure, right, the way we're seeing Bernie Sanders and the popularity that he's got growing. But again, it shows you the Democratic Party establishment, whether it's in Florida or nationally, is kind of just like the Republican establishment is, I guess, right out to, you know, out of it, right, in terms of where the base is at, in terms of where their support is. And Murphy has been, you know, even Barney Frank has endorsed Patrick Murphy, right? And I actually asked him about that. I was really surprised at the Democratic convention, state convention back on Halloween. Barney Frank came out, flew out there for that with Claire McCaskill, and who else was there? Amy Klobuchar, the senator from Minnesota, and they all came out and endorsed Murphy because, you know, as you know, the Senate can turn with what, four different senators go from Republican to Democrat, states do. The Democrats can take over the Senate. And next year, Murphy as being the guy who can do it better than Grayson, but they may be wrong.
Well, you've got a couple of things going on with Grayson. One is his challenge is showing up. Wasserman Schultz walking around with a Hillary button during debates was really kind of an upsetting thing to certain people. And Tulsi Gabbard is challenging her, and she's the vice chair of the DNC. But with respect to Grayson, he is one demanding the release or the declassification of the 28 pages from 9/11. Which have been demanded by Bob Graham, and it's requiring someone going to Congress and putting it on the floor to debate that issue, which makes him even much more of a lightning rod to the status quo. It's been curious that Obama has promised to declassify those 28 pages and hasn't done it up to now. He's in his last year. This is a great opportunity for somebody who's challenging for election in the state. And at the same time, Mitch, we've got a situation where the redistricting thing is going to affect the Senate. And Judge, I can't think of his name now, Edwards, I think, Reynolds, that's the name, his ruling is going to be standing, and that I've heard that the legislature and the Republicans have decided not to challenge it any longer.
That's correct, right. So state Senate seats, right.
We're speaking to Mitch Perry, reporter and editor. Mitch, can you let the audience know what your current position is? I know you've worked for WMNF and a couple of the different news sources. What are you doing right now?
Yeah, I'm a reporter for a couple of different websites, FloridaPolitics.com and StPetersBlog.com. And Florida Politics is more statewide issues and national issues even, covering a lot of the presidential race of Jeb Bush and Marco Rubio. And St. Peter's Blog is more of Tampa Bay-oriented stories.
Mm-hmm. And, are you on full salary in one of those positions, or are you in partial salary? I mean, the St. Peter's Blog is noted for growing by leaps and bounds. Is that still true?
We're right, absolutely. It's the same team. I mean, actually, my publisher, Peter Sorsch, he has, like, numerous websites, but those are the two that I write for. Those are our two biggest ones. And again, they're separated because one's more Tampa Bay-oriented, one's more focused on Tallahassee and broader issues of the state.
Well, we're finding out that people are at least determining that people are something.
I saw it here. The CSX train is going through here where I'm standing at down here in South Tampa right now.
I thought maybe you were on a train headed for New Hampshire. Anyway, people are listening to the podcast as much as they are the show, so we're discovering this is a growing trend. People don't have the time at a certain time, so you have to. It invites a lot of people to do podcasting in and of itself, and that growing trend is starting to set in through the country. There's your train again. Don't miss. Did you get tickets?
I'm outside because I'm actually covering a city council and he's giving a speech right now.
Don't apologize. Don't apologize. It's okay.
That's why hopefully this train's going to go pretty quickly here. But
that's stage effect, right?
I'm amazed, actually. I didn't know that this is like kind of like middle of the morning here. There's a lot of traffic here when I'm at South Howard in the South Tampa area.
Well, you know.
Anyway,
go ahead.
But I'm also. I want to say to you, your listeners, I am going to be going to New Hampshire, actually, a week from Tuesday, right? You know, of course, a week from Monday, we have the Iowa caucus, And then the next day, or the next week, of course, 8 days later is New Hampshire. So I'm going to fly up to New Hampshire right after the Iowa caucus is finished. And to me, it's going to be like, I mean, you know, Bernie Sanders is looking very solid that he's going to win New Hampshire now. I guess the question is what we'll do in Iowa. But on the Republican side, I think it's going to be fascinating because, you know, the question, I think Donald Trump is leading pretty solidly in New Hampshire in the Republican race, but the question is who's going to come in second, who's going to come in third? And I think you've got Marco Rubio, Jeb Bush, John Kasich, and Chris Christie all fighting to be like the comeback kid like Bill Clinton was in 92, if you recall. Bill Clinton never won New Hampshire, but they spun it so adroitly that he was, you know, the star of that primary. Actually, Paul Tsongas won it, you know, and gave him that momentum to get the nomination that year. And I think with a lot of these establishment candidates, particularly Jeb Bush, now Jeb, South Carolina comes after New Hampshire, and apparently those two states are going to determine Jeb Bush's any future whatsoever. I know it looks pretty bleak, you know, according to every darn poll. But you still have to believe the establishment's going to still try to rally around somebody. I don't know if you heard about that National Review last night.
Yes, I did. They came out against Trump.
Big time, with 22 different writers coming out and saying different reasons why they're opposing him. And by the way, you know, whatever your ideology is, you know, they're absolutely correct when they say he's not a true conservative. And for people at National Review, they care about that stuff. But, of course, you know, people who are supporting Trump don't care about it. They just like all the stuff that he's saying that he'll never be able to accomplish. Well, it sounds great, he's doing so well, you know.
The thing that I'm noticing among ordinary folk out there when you bring up conversations and politics and things, they say, well, I'm not going to be politically correct, but, and they go on to some other variety
right.
of subjects, which means they're echoing Trump. And that's a real telling thing, I do believe. And lately, the endorsements that are coming forward in behalf of Bush, but particularly Rubio, are the greatest in the case of Rubio, in that he has the most coming from the Senate and from the House, both.
But he doesn't have Sarah Palin's endorsement.
Oh, darn. anyway, I've got to put our number out for people who are listening this morning, on this rainy morning, 941-745. You'd like to have a little conversation with Mitch Perry as well, and 945-745-1490. Anyway.
941.
Oh, it's 941. I did leave that. Thank you for that, Floyd. Paul Krugman is on both sides of the coin here with respect to Bernie Sanders. One, today's editorial, he's saying that, and so many words, the enemy of the good is the perfect, and don't dream too much, and don't put your faith in your dreams, and don't put your faith in Bernie. But the polling says nationally that Bernie would do better against Hillary.
Do better than Hillary against a Republican, you mean?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, I agree with you. I see some of those. I wouldn't take any of those too seriously, right? I mean, I think that the only polls we should seriously care about too much is these first two ones, only because who knows if it's going to be a one-on-one with all, you know. But I understand that. The Bernie people like to pump those things up. The Paul Krugman column today was very interesting, you know, where he's trying not to downplay the dreams of the... did you see what Krugman wrote? I mean, I thought it was so interesting where he said that... he said that Hillary Clinton is running like more like Bernie Sanders is running more like Barack Obama, the candidate in 2008, whereas Hillary Clinton is running more like Barack Obama, the president, in the last 7 years, where
that's
you know what
analogy.
Actually you can get done versus what you hope you can get done. And I think that's, you know, that's not a conservative. I mean, Bernie Sanders fans may get upset about that, but I think that, you know, I think Barack Obama's done, you know, if you're a progressive, I think he's been the most progressive president of my lifetime. He hasn't gone as far as some people would like. But my gosh, we know the kind of Congress he's working with. I mean, now you need 60 votes in the Senate.
Well,
you get a lot of things done that he's like
Sanders
to get done, right? I mean, you know, so I always think that people, some liberals give Obama, I mean, I think he definitely deserves criticism, don't get me wrong, but I'm just saying that under the circumstances that he's been under, only having the Democrats for 2 years with him, he's accomplished a lot, I think.
Well, they keep, and Sanders rightly brings up FDR, but the difference is there was no 22nd Amendment at the time of FDR, and you were not limited to a two-term presidency. And so FDR could plan long range. And if we didn't have the 20, which I think is a mistake on the part of the Republicans, it hurts anybody that's reasonably successful and figures out what to do in their job, you got to stay long enough to learn the damn job, and you can't learn it in a year or two and be effective without turning around and have to run for it all over again, and then be effective only two more years in your second term if you get a second term. So this thing, this government that we have is the one that was created out of a reaction to somebody who had won a world war, world's greatest generation, FDR, died in office to maintain the effort of winning the war and confronting the Soviet. And instead of keeping, I'm trying to think who it was that was going to replace him, was going to be his vice president, puts Harry Truman in, if nobody had any faith in, who scraped by under against Dewey in 48, you have a situation where spending, investing in the country became the mantra of that time, and that they stopped spending on the military. They shut it down almost entirely. But they did it, they maintained spending on the social justice front, which is to get the GIs educated in jobs and all the rest, and then build the interstate highway system, with Eisenhower, who basically was endorsed by Truman. So it's an interesting time that we're in when you make that comparison. I think Obama has been fantastic for what he's had to put up with. His mistake,
right.
His mistake, I believe, was he could have done two things at the same time. Had he done the first one, to rebuild the infrastructure with high-speed rail and really made that an effort, and then brought and then said Medicare for everybody and let the Congress figure it out how they're going to throw that albatross off their neck.
Well, you know, I would just say about that, and that's, of course, what Bernie Sanders is campaigning on, but I would say, and I know some people say negotiation-wise, maybe Obama should have called for single-payer, you know, up front, or the public option up front as a negotiating ploy, and that was kind of taken off the table immediately. But let's be honest, he got that health care bill, which, you know, working through the insurance companies, he got that passed with, like, minimum passed, as it were, you know what I mean? That is with a, you know, barely enough vote to get through, right?
Right.
I think that he's done a lot, you know, and I think that, I think that he is, you know, so when Sanders argues for what he, you know, it's interesting because Hillary Clinton is coming after him now saying that,
he's unrealistic.
His plans are, you know, she wants to revamp the Affordable Care Act, which, by the way, I went on January 1, you know. I'm actually on Obamacare, if you will, right now. And I do think, just a segue into talking about that, I do think that we all know, I think, you know, you don't have to be on Obama, the ACA, to know that it's got some issues. It's not just Republicans who are, you know, I think the Democrats get in their corners, and everybody talks about how we need to fix it, right? It's okay, but it can be improved. But they don't want to get too specific about that. Because they think they're so into defending it from being totally torn apart or repealed, which is what the Republicans say they'll do if there's Donald Trump or Ted Cruz elected president next January, right? They're going to get rid of it. I think Democrats would be wiser to talk about what they would specifically do to fix it, you know, right now if they were somehow elected.
That's a wonderful point.
You miss out on that kind of...
Yeah, that is, of course, my attitude is take away the profit out of healthcare. Healthcare should not be a for-profit business, a utility that people have to have, just like water, like Flint, Michigan. I mean, look at that mess. When you let the corporatization of government get in the way, and that's what healthcare is, the corporatization of a government utility for the people, and we're arguing about something that shouldn't even be... What they're doing now is they're changing the deductibles or maneuvering people to where they can't afford to go forward with the care.
Exactly. That's a big. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt, but you're right. I mean, that's some and some people, it's just not worth it, right? It's just not worth it to pay whatever you have to pay. Now, see, I have it. I'm on it not because I can't afford it. It's because I'm not getting employer based health care through my employer, right? So I had to go out in the open market, as it were, and obtain it that way. I can afford it, but I'm not sure, you know, my monthly premiums are pretty expensive. But then again, I was on COBRA for the last year, right, which is, you know, definitely expensive. So, but there are people who, you know, through subsidies can get on it because, you know, they're not that wealthy. But yet, as you mentioned, you know, they're getting to pay so much out of pocket, or their drugs or what have you. So people are really saying, you know, is it really worth it? You know, and I think that's why it still needs to be improved, not repealed, And by the way, I don't think Republicans, even if Republicans took over, I don't think they'd be able to do that. I think that there's some too many things that are positive with it that will make it impossible to do that.
Well, the principal issue is government is the problem, not the solution, a la Ronald Reagan. But what he really meant was, let's defund government. He started off by dropping the marginal tax rate to 28% from 60% at the time he took over. When we were a lender nation, actually, at that time, under Carter, much as people like to bash Carter. But then he jacked the rates up four or five times to get it up to 35%, nickel-diming the marginal rates up a little bit, but not near enough to keep from going tripling the debt that he did. And so this is what I think the same tactic is being used on the healthcare thing. Nickel and dime it, make people lose faith in it, and let the people walk away because they can't afford it, and let the insurance companies do it
justification. The thing is that also you heard, back before the end of the year, United Healthcare, who was involved with this, said that they may walk away because they're unhappy because they say that there's too many people who are too sick on it, right? Too many older people are signing up for it, and it's killing them, And by the way, the Obama administration has reacted to this. The administration has previously allowed, the deadline to sign up for Obamacare, I believe, is at the end of January, right? Just another week or so, right? For the enrollment for this year. Now, in the last 2 years, they've had, quote-unquote, special enrollments. They've done a lot of special enrollments where they allow people for different reasons, even though they missed the deadline, to get on it, they sign up. And the healthcare companies have complained so much that that's not going to happen this year, or at least the exemptions are going to be much fewer in number. And the reason for that is because they say these people don't sign up and only until they're really sick, and then they're killing us because we're not getting enough younger people on this thing, which is why you want to, the pool of people, as insurance works, of course, you have a lot of people who don't need insurance versus those who do need it. And right now, they say there's too many people who are coming on who do need it, and it's costing them. And I know people criticized Obama was working with the insurance companies, but look, the Clintons tried to not work with the insurance companies, 25 years ago, whatever, and they got killed. Again, I thought it was a smart move by Obama, bring them in the tent versus outside the tent, but they may go outside the tent anyway, though, because if it's not, the bottom line isn't working for them, they're not going to work it, and that's going to make things really troublesome and dangerous. In terms of how it's going to work going forward.
We're going to take a brief break, and we will be back with Mitch Perry in just a short moment.
A man who walks with the animals, talks with the animals.
Sarasota is home to a true gift, the Posture Clinic of Sarasota, with Dr. Mark D'Amato. 4450 South Tamiami Trail, Dr. D'Amato is a veterinary chiropractor, treating horses, dogs, or your favorite four-legged friend. First and foremost, animal chiropractic care is not intended to replace traditional veterinary medicine. Complementary care is a type of care that works with your vet, and certainly not instead of them. To find out more information, call Dr. Mark D'Amato at 941-927-7009. That's 941-927-7009.
And we are back with our guest, Mitch Perry, reporter for the FloridaPolitics.com and St. Pete's Blog.com.
And he does a midday report once a week for WMNF. You still have your toe in the water there, Mitch. And that was where I heard your report with Mr. Canova.
Right. 12 to 1 p.m. every Thursday afternoon on WMNF. Thanks, sir, for bringing that up.
You stir the water well, and I think this Flint situation, and speaking of the water, is one that I think is going to really rise up, because the executive takeover by the state is an interesting phenomena. It's not isolated to Michigan. We've got a similar thing proposed in a number of states, and Kansas is one of them, and they're all looking at taking over. Now, what is the point of a state taking over? I think they took over
they took over Detroit, right?
They took over Flint.
They took over Detroit because of Detroit's financial problems.
There's another city.
And then they also did take over Flint, actually,
But there's another city as well. And the point was, in each of these cities, were predominantly black populations. And so they're calling it racial something or other as a result.
Well, in the case of Flint, they're calling it environmental racism, for sure.
Right.
But I think that, I mean, we're still learning more. I mean, I'm still learning more about the whole situation of Flint. And I think that it does remind me of Katrina in terms of, like, you just can't blame one entity for this. You know, when something goes so bad, so wrong, it's the local, it's the state, it's the federal even. You know, I mean, as the regional administrator of the EPA apparently quit, I saw right in the news this morning. Mm-hmm. And so it goes into the feds. I know people want to make a political football about it and blame this and that, and I think everybody's at fault. Who's got any level of responsibility overseeing the people of Flint.
But the takeover of these governments, of duly kicking aside duly elected officials on the part of the state to suggest something else, what happens when a state takes over all these facilities that they're normally held at the local level because the tax revenue isn't sufficient to come to the state, and they're going to make sure that that's what is first and foremost. And when the doctors went to the governor about this, he ignored it. That's the word, anyway. But the problem with this is it points not just to Flint, but it points to the country as a whole. The infrastructure is falling apart. And the billions of dollars it's going to take to replace it are billions of dollars that we don't need to spend in another damn war. So the choices here, and this is what Bernie, I think, is bringing forward fairly well. And so you're going to be seeing, I'm sure, the Flint thing is going to come flying up forward in almost all these conversations.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. Well, I mean, let's just hope that these people get, you know, clean water, right? And let's start with the basics here. And then try to figure it out afterwards.
But my point was trying to intimate something here. You hear government is the problem, not the solution, but when government's absent, or government becomes state government over local government, or when government then turns around and sells the utility to private industry, like Jeb Bush proposed when he was governor here, when he said, won't it be wonderful when these halls are empty in Tallahassee? He said that on his second inaugural as governor. And that's the attitude
right.
of these Republicans
right.
is it's an opportunity for the corporations, and how can they hand these utilities over, and how can they make money at the expense of the population as a whole? I mean, you've got to.
Yeah.
I mean, well, I'm just asking. It's a question, much as anything, Mitch.
Hey, I think I'm going to have to get going in just a couple minutes. I hate to cut off the
all
conversation.
Right, well, what's your first agenda item when you go to New Hampshire and tell us what?
Oh, well, I'm just going to be covering the candidates. You know, I mean, I'm going to cover for sure. It's funny because I have some of the candidates I'm trying to get the access. I don't usually get their press releases, but I'm going to definitely cover a lot of Trump and I got Trump and Sanders, but also Marco Rubio and Jeb Bush. I mean, me being part of FloridaPolitics.com, right? It's definitely to cover the Florida guys. So that's going to be my main responsibility. But you know, interestingly, there's a class out of USF St. Pete that is going to be going up there. That I look forward to following some of these students. They're all going to be volunteering for the different campaigns. Professor at USF St. Pete, Timothy McLaughlin, who ran for office a couple years ago against State Senator Jeff Brandis, lost that seat. But nevertheless, she has got some. She brings her class there every 4 years or so to kind of get involved with direct democracy and working for the campaigns. So I look forward. I'll be writing stories about that as well, just in terms of seeing how these young people look at this whole crazy thing that we call democracy in America, or elections in America, at least.
Can you get these kids to the idea, don't just vote in a general election, vote in the state elections? I mean, that's the real dilemma.
I'm sorry, I didn't get to hear you there.
I said the dilemma seems to be that young people are all wild to vote in general elections, but they don't show up in the state elections.
I think that goes for... There's so many people like that, too, or even local elections, mm-hmm. right? I mean, people seem to know what's going on way more about in Washington, D.C. versus, in our case, in Tallahassee or in the Bay Area. And I was like that as a young person, you know, in my 20s. I kind of certainly followed the presidential and even the Senate seats, but I didn't follow what was going on in my neighborhood. And as I've gotten older, you realize that, when it comes to local issues, that's where you have the most power as a citizen in America, I feel, you know, where you can... to communicate with your city council members or county commissioners. Again, I'm at this meeting right now at a little cafe here in Tampa where a city councilman's talking to, these neighborhood issues to people here, and they're literally talking to him and having him answer directly about what's going on here. And even Tallahassee, it gets pretty big. You know, too big for us, but we can't seemingly control what they do up there. But when it comes to Washington, I mean, my gosh, right? I mean, what, how much, in a way, can we affect it? I mean, I think that's not being cynical. I think that's sadly just, you know, what happens, basically. So I think you're right. Young people are more focused on that because it's more in the news, more on cable TV. It's more, you read about those stories more than you do about these local and state issues. But in fact, they're more, in many cases, more important to what our, how we affects our lives.
Well, Mitch, I really want to thank you for coming, and I don't want to hold you any longer than you need be. If there's any final thought, I'd appreciate it, and we'll get you back on here when you have a little more time.
Yeah, no, definitely. I look forward to coming on sometime soon again. Thanks. Thank you, guys.
Okay, thank you, Mitch.
Thanks.
Okay, well, there we go. You know, I was just at a meeting, Floyd, yesterday with the Nations Group, and they've created something of an alliance which seems to be fraying at the moment. They discovered that in Sarasota, the black community is really being bought off by the Republicans. Buchanan has tied up the various ministers for the Bishop Porter, who's a Republican, and Nate, I can't think of his last name, who's the black theater guy. And so all the really prominent leaders in the black community, not all, but most, are becoming Republicans. Guillory, the woman that did the homeless thing, was a Democrat. She switched. She got some help financially from the Republicans, and she switched to the Republicans as part of the bargain. Carolyn Mason, years ago, took $2,000 from the Democrats on one night, on a meeting night from the Teamsters in Sarasota, and she proceeded 2 weeks later to get a deal on a mortgage on her house from the Republicans and agreed to become a Republican. She sits as a Republican county commissioner now in Sarasota. Gee whiz.
Money talks. Mm-hmm. There's a secondary issue of immigration. Now, this is a very questionable issue. There's the alleged premise that blacks are opposed to liberal immigration because it takes away potential jobs for them. And blacks want to work, and if they have now the extra competition from people across the border, it makes it more difficult for them to survive. And yet I've heard other black individuals say, well, this is not truly the case because we have already paid our dues. We've worked here. We don't want to spend our time bending over the fields of picking tomatoes and strawberries and mowing lawns. We want to have more respectful and more profitable jobs. But the Republicans are definitely courting the black population right now.
Well, they can do it effectively in communities, especially when the population is small. And with this breakup, which we didn't get into enough with Mitch, of the districts, the straightening out of the districts so that it turns out that the Senate is going to be equally balanced, and the likelihood is Democrats will match up the Democrats and the Republicans in the Senate.
It may come close.
But that makes a difference in the power of the governor as well when you get that to happen. But
there's not a supermajority. The supermajority means basically you discard any kind of interests or thoughts of the other party.
Which is what is the other way now.
Which is what it is right now. Yeah. So even if the Democrats do not have an equal balance, they simply will not be relegated to the corners because of the vast majority of the Republicans have this supermajority. And that makes a difference as far as procedural movements in Tallahassee.
Mm-hmm. And of course, I didn't bring it up to Mitch, and I always like to bring it up in any conversation. When you have Tallahassee in Tallahassee and the government's there, you're really too removed from a big chunk of the population. Large population concentrations are clear down in the south in Miami and Miami-Dade and all the way up the east coast and somewhat on the west coast, but nowhere near the Tallahassee area. And Orlando would be far better a place for our government to be, so you could go there, listen live, and not have to watch it on television or C-SPAN or something like that.
I think Rick Scott would be better suited for Disney World than Tallahassee.
Well, he would. They probably, when he retires from office, they'll honor him with a twin called Goofy. And, you know, we just have this clown there
he's not a clown. He's been very successful.
Well, the clown is someone who makes the dangers of the lions and the tigers seem less. They're behind bars, aren't they? They're not going to bother you. We're going to protect you from those dangerous people. And that's a clown who, and we're going to keep them there for the rest of their life, even if they deserve to be free and not in jail any longer. But that's a euphemism, an analogy that probably passes over some people. Again, we're free of the conversation with our guest on the line, and it's 941-745-1490. The thing that Bernie has suggested is breaking up the banks, and Hillary's bothered by that one. The bank nationalization, or no, he wants to break them up, doesn't he?
He said in his last debate, he says, they said before the banks were too big to fail. Well, they're bigger now. They are bigger. A couple of them fell by the wayside during the Great Recession, and these banks are bigger and more powerful right now, and it's just very dangerous, and they're going back to the same old things that they were doing before. It's a frightening situation.
Well, and that is why he Bernie Sanders has proposed restoring Glass-Steagall, which is much more strict version of Dodd-Frank, and which is what worked for us up until Reagan came in and destroyed that with a number of efforts in 1987, nearly put us into a situation with breaking down of the funding of the SNL, so savings and loans, and the funding for that, and opened it up to widespread speculation, which was a depletion of $4 billion in their funding in 87, or prior to 87. The crash hit in 87, or the near crash. And then you had the result. Seidman was the guy that handled financial crash that occurred because of the defunding of the SNLs by Reagan himself, by executive order. He allowed $4 billion to be handed off as investing that anybody could borrow against as collateral, and they ended up paying out in losses $500 billion. So it was a huge mistake by the great defunder Ronald Reagan, and his heroism in the face of the big bad government was to make government what he said it was, something he had no regard for. And I think that's been the issue of Republicans. They hold him up as an idol, not FDR. They want to put Ronald Reagan on Mount Rushmore, for God's sake. What a mess. What an idea. They probably will have to get somebody that knows how to glue stones together in the cheapest fashion. We'll do it in plaster so the first rainfall will wash it away, which is where it deserves to be washed away. In our
You were talking about the banking and the savings and loan. Mm-hmm. Now, somehow I'm reminded of something called Silverado savings and loan.
Neil Bush.
There's mm-hmm. another Bush mm-hmm. brother that people aren't aware of. There was George Herbert Walker and George W., both presidents. Then there was Silverado savings and loan.
Well, he went before a judge. And he went before a judge in the Bush administration. It followed the Reagan administration. So Bush administration could call it the third term of Ronald Reagan. He went before a judge, and the judge says, well, you've suffered too much embarrassment. I'm just going to limit your future to no banking, but you can do whatever else you want to do in life, but you're not going to be a banker any longer. And that was a punishment. He's been part of the Carlyle Group now forever. Carlyle Group is a big oil group that has done lots of bad things. The Alan Grayson thing and the 28 pages, if Alan Grayson decides, if he looks like he's going to be successful in the Rubio situation, that would be quite a coup for the Democrats. I don't know that I'm going to try to get a hold of Ron, Alan, I say Ronald, but Alan Grayson, to maybe come on the show. The debates are Sunday night between Hillary and Bernie, and is she feeling the burn now? Because I think that's what's at stake here. The Flint thing, I think, is definitely going to come in the business. I'm looking here at the New York Times, and there is a single payer program feasible, is the argument among the letter writers, and essentially, while the Affordable Care Act has indeed been a great help for many seeking health insurance, It has left over one-fourth of Americans age 18 to 64 with problems paying their medical bills, has been reported, and that can be the case even for those with insurance, medical debt often crushing even for those insured. We can do better at every developed nation has demonstrated. The writer's professor of pediatrics at Boston University School of Medicine, a founding member of the Physicians for National Health. I think the point that Bernie is offering, and I think it's a good one, is he wants to, you know, every transaction, you put a penny tax on every stock transaction. It's a very low cost. It's when you go, when you do a transaction in any kind of business relationship, you pay a fee. If you have a check that goes bad, you pay a fee. So you have situations that invite some kind of cost to the public, and I think the healthcare system is one of them, and that would be a way to go. So do we have a caller?
We have John from Sarasota. Good John, morning. Welcome to the Morning Edge.
On this rainy
Hi,
day.
Hi, fellas, I'm back.
Great, glad to have you back. A perfect day to call in.
I can contribute to the dismal weather. I've got a few dismal facts that I've collected over the last two or three days. Or we can talk about, you've been hinting around about Mr. Krugman here and his article, I think it was a couple of days ago, about, which I totally agree with, how if we could start all over again from scratch, single payer would be great. If I had the flexibility to live just about anywhere else where they had universal health care, I might consider it, especially at my age. But
well, there is a place.
So where do you want me to go? Let me give you an interesting fact that I heard yesterday.
Sure. I was going to give you a place to go, which you might think about, actually. So.
Okay, well, that might be better than some suggestions people made this earlier where I should go. But
that's all right.
but we live in a Republican county, don't we?
Yeah, there
so,
we go.
Not so much
anymore, by the way.
To me.
Yeah.
This was fascinating. Tom Hartman, I think I heard this on Tom Hartman yesterday. This is a fascinating little historical little bit of information. Apparently, Woody Guthrie, the great, great progressive, from the 30s, 40s, and 50s, lived in a rental property owned by Donald Trump's father, Fred Trump. And he actually wrote a song about Fred Trump and this segregated property that he lived in. Isn't that just amazing?
You got to get that song, John. We got to play that on the show.
Yeah. Well, you can start with, I love Woody Guthrie. I've often thought you guys ought to lead off with, you know, This Land Is Our Land by Woody Guthrie. Mm-hmm. I just would love to hear that in the morning. That's a great national anthem. Woody Guthrie, This Land Is Your Land. You know, I just love
That's
it.
All right. That's all right. This Land Is Your Land, yeah.
Here's another little interesting data on a dismal day. I can give you very dismal data that I heard. But let me give you this. Here, at least nationally, and this one little piece of information explains everything. Maybe it was out of. I haven't been able to either listen or call in. I was able to yesterday, but I've had a lot of obligations. But a U.S. senator, for every day of his 6-year term, has to raise $10,000 a day.
Mm-hmm.
$10,000 a day. That explains everything.
Yes,
that explains the denial on global warming. That explains the destruction of the middle class. That explains, you know, the paltry wages everybody's making. That explains everything.
30 hours a week making phone calls to raise money is a typical time.
Yep.
30 hours a week making phone calls.
How can you expect? I worked with a certain, in my business I had in Illinois, I worked with a certain client, and when I realized that client was a problem, for about 5 years I put up with it, and I decided the first opportunity I had to leave the business because it was too dependent on them. I was going to do that, and I finally did. And it was a Catholic church. I did a lot of work with and for them, because I saw the in 78, 79, I saw where they were going, and I just felt I did not want to be associated anymore. And all the scandals were, I was aware of them way before most of the innocent people were, who were trying to hang on and keep on hanging on. So a congressman is in the same boat. He's got to run for office, and he's got to run for money. He's really running for money to run for office. And that's the tragedy. And Bernie has done...
got to pay to play.
Bernie has done a magical job. They want to call him a socialist. And I think a socialist would be somebody who would nationalize our banks, not break them up. Nationalize them so corporates could take over in an even a bigger way.
The whole socialism business just drives me nuts. Because it's not... if you have a cup of coffee in the morning, and if you can just add 2 + 2 = 4, you realize this isn't so much a commentary on Bernie Sanders. It is a commentary on the absolutely pathetic, fallen, corrupted nature of our media. You know, because... you'd think with this vast media network we have in this country, you know, from mainstream to alternative sources, you'd think that there'd be tremendous amounts of pushback by supposedly independent media that, no, he's not a communist. No, he's not going to nationalize all the industries. That he's no different than Tony Blair, maybe David Cameron, maybe Angela Merkel. Okay, and look at his program.
But those are the conservatives of Europe.
You think he's going to do away, and it's not. First of all, he has been. He's a wonderful man. He's got a heart of gold. He's like the Martin Luther King of this era in some ways. But he's been so terribly naive.
Well, one thing
you go into the American, you know, boxing ring, you know, okay. Say, well, yes, I'm a democratic socialist, and get away. You know, they're crucified, but it's the media. The really insight into this is how corrupt our media is. Even supposedly liberal MSNBC. You know, he is no different than almost every leader, you know, in the world in Western Europe. He's not against the free market, not going to nationalize industries. And it's just so dispiriting and just disgusting how the media is just, you know,
well, they're jumping around. They don't know which seat to sit in, which bed to fall in, and which consummate relationship to develop. Bernie is really, as you mentioned, following what would be considered in Europe conservative politicians.
Yes, and you know, Hawkey, because you're over there. You know,
exactly.
Yet Bernie would be considered center. He would be considered center.
You're not liberal.
You know, and what's Tony Blair comes over here, and we just, every interviewer and host from Charlie Rose to God knows even Fox, right, they just bow down, and he, you know, Bernie is probably to the right of Tony Blair.
Yeah, but the pragmatics of our politics are the key here. How do we make this political scene change? I mean, I brought it up at the Nations Group meeting I was at yesterday. In Sarasota County, you have 5 districts that are meaningless. You're just required to run from a district. You have to live there, and then you're required to run from the district. But you're not elected by the district. You're elected by the county. So the poor bastard that has no money has to run countywide and get money to do that, get advertising to do that, because it's the county that decides your seat, not that district you're in. And Mr. Hines, who sits on the county commission of Sarasota, sits there, and he lost to 2 different people, more votes than he did in the last countywide election. Well, in the charter of the Sarasota County, the charter review board is more powerful than the county commission, but the Republicans control it, and they do not want to allow what we did in 1991 to change it back to single member voting. In other words, you have to win your seat in your district to sit on the county commission. And at that time, a guy by the name of Jack O'Neill in Sarasota County won a seat It cost him a magnificent amount of $5,000 to run and win his seat.
Can I say something real quickly, Augie?
Sure.
You know, about how we change things. Okay. You know, with the, he had 30% turnout in the last, you know, midterms.
Mm-hmm.
You know, statewide, et cetera. And I think in St. Pete, they had less than 20% in their citywide mm-hmm. election. If you would get people like Cornell West and Tavis Smiley and Russell Simmons and some other, you know, and maybe, Springsteen, you know, and if they would spend a year not writing books, not writing songs, you know, just going around this country and just a massive PR push to get people to vote, you know, to get people to come out in midterms like they do in national elections, that would change things.
Well, that's your organize, and if the leaders of the black community will not do it and would rather pompously bash the existing leader all the time, and that's what Cornell West does, to his discredit, when he doesn't do what you're talking.
I mean, he could have an enormous impact. He and Tavis Smiley, rather than sitting there and, you know, screaming from the peanut galleries, they could have an enormous impact if they got... They got people to come out in the midterms, and they have the power to do it. On this dismal day, one final thing. You all may have seen this, Augie. I know because you read the Sarasota Tribune a lot. But on this dismal day, for any other readers out there, go to yesterday's Sarasota Tribune and read Dana Milback.
I did.
The Banks column. The gospel according to Trump. There's nothing like the Bible. It's just, my God. It's just,
well,
it's
I
just
think-
beautiful.